You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Award-winning historian and cartographer Rick Britton is a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. In January and February of 2010, Rick presented 6 lectures in a new series entitled Characters of Central Virginia, The Famous, The Infamous, and The Undeniably Odd. The series was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. In this podcast, you'll meet Tech Sergeant Frank Dabney Peregoy. Born in Nelson County and raised in Charlottesville, Peregoy was posthumously awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor in a ceremony at the Charlottesville City Armory on June 4, 1945. The National Guardsman and a member of the Monticello Guard had performed an amazing feat of heroism in France on D-Day Plus 2. Here's Rick Britton.
And I'm going to read you a quote at the very beginning. The reason this quote is important, it's from a war correspondent who was born in Charlottesville, Charles Christian Wurtenbaker. War is 3 things. It is a way of deciding great differences among people. That is the politician's war. It is a game of infinite complexity. That is the general's war. And it is a personal experience of weariness, hatred, terror, filth, and occasional patriotism and humor. That is the soldier's war. The Normandy town of Grand Camp Les Bains lies 10 miles west of Omaha Beach on the main coastal highway. Prior to the war, the 1,500 inhabitants had occupied themselves with bringing in the day's catch and catering to those who had come to enjoy the pleasant beaches. On the afternoon of June 8, 1944, however, the fishing village was anything but tranquil. As American troops approached from the east, German forces in the town opened up with heavy mortar and machine gun fire. Their positions seemed impregnable. On D-Day plus 2, Grand Camp Les Bains certainly looked like it was going to be a tough nut. The town was on a knoll, remembers Carl Chubby Prophet of Charlottesville, an 80-year-old veteran of the 116th Infantry. The ground dipped down from there. I remember in particular a huge church steeple. The Germans were dug in front of the town and had fortifications all around it. In order to deny access, they had mined the highway. Adding to the man-made defenses was a marshy stream flowing toward the sea, which the Germans had purposely flooded, making it a virtual moat. In order to assail Grand Camp, the Americans had to traverse the bog over a small bridge and attack uphill across an open 200-yard field. Scattered patches of high grass would afford the only means of cover. It was the only way in, says Prophet. Earlier in the day, Grand Camp had been hammered by huge naval shells lobbed in by the British cruiser Glasgow. Unfortunately, this one-hour bombardment had failed to dislodge or even discourage the enemy. The first assault of the afternoon was made by men of the 5th Ranger Battalion. Behind them was deployed a 29th Division unit, the 3rd Battalion, 116th Infantry, Virginia boys from Charlottesville and the central Piedmont. Crouching low, the Rangers crossed the bridge and fanned out. On the enemy side, the highway was blocked by a Sherman tank minus one of its treads. It had struck a mine. Picking their way up the slope, the Rangers were greeted by a vicious hail of metal. Machine gun rounds kicked up the earth at their feet. Mortar shells split the air with ear-deafening blasts. The Rangers dropped and attempted to return the fire. Many of them never rose again. With their advance stopped cold, they sent back for help. Now it was the 116th's turn. Evening was fast approaching as a portion of the 3rd Battalion, 116th Infantry, perhaps as many as 250 men, began its advance. Beyond the marsh, K and L companies moved through the Rangers, wrote Joseph H. Ewing in his history of the 29th Division, and attacked astride the road. We went right through them, echoes Chubby Prophet of K Company, and continued right against Grand Camp. The Rangers had already taken heavy casualties, you see, in the landing 2 days earlier. Company K hit the Germans on the right of the line, along the highway and to the north. They immediately encountered stiff resistance. Prophet remembers the Germans opening up as soon as the Virginians came into view. They pinned us down real sharply, he says. Repeated assaults, this according to Gertrude Dana Parlier, were turned back by machine gun and rifle fire. Company K's commander, Captain William G. Pingley, Jr. of Winchester, was killed, leading his men forward. It was obvious to many on that bullet-swept slope that something else, something different, had to be done. A battalion officer later recalled seeing one man from Company K, one American GI, crouching forward through the withering fire that commanded that hillside. He was slowly working his way up to the crest, armed only with his rifle, bayonet, and a few hand grenades. It seemed miraculous that he wasn't being hit. Taking the situation into his own hands, Technical Sergeant Frank Dabney Paragoy of Charlottesville, Virginia, was going it alone. Frank Dabney Paragoy was born on April 10th, 1916, in the town of Faber, Nelson County, Virginia. His parents were Susie Edward Allen and James Paragoy, a farmer and itinerant laborer. Between the years 1922-1923, this according to his relative Janet Periello, James and Susie moved their family to Esmont in Albemarle County. They made their home across the road from James's brother, John Dabney. According to Periello, Frank was the second born of 11 children and was the youngest son. The youngest of the family, 72-year-old Don Paragoy, maintains that only 8 of the children reached maturity, 4 boys and 4 girls. Several had been stillborn. Mother Susie, unfortunately, died in 1931, and James followed her to the grave, but 4 years later. Orphaned, wrote Periello, the family stayed together for a short while and then separated to live with other family members. Frank Dabney Paragoy, therefore, came of age during the country's worst economic period, the Great Depression, while his family was dissolving all around him. In response, he became very protective, as you can imagine. We had a great big grapevine swing out near the house, and we were all up there, you know, swinging, remembers Don Paragoy. Born in 1926, Don was 10 years younger than his big brother, Frank. Some boys from elsewhere, somewhere else, were there about Frank's size, see, he says, and one of them was pushing me. I said I wanted to quit, see, but he said, oh, no, you can go, you can keep going, and he pushed me, so I let go of the swing. I can remember it so clearly. I dropped down into the leaves and dirt. It didn't hurt me a bit, but Frank runs to me and says he was giving the others hell for swinging me again, and they left. Frank was ready to tangle with them over me, see? On another occasion, a local man was harassing one of Frank's smaller sisters. She was a young girl, 9 or 10, recalls Don. Some man would come out in the morning when she was going to school and say, "My, what a pretty little girl you are." Well, it frightened her because he was doing it so persistently. So she told Frank. So Frank sneaked along behind her, you know, going to school. And the man did come out and was talking to her. So Frank stepped out and told the man that he wanted him to leave his sister alone. The man immediately apologized and never bothered her again. The important thing, I think, from a historical viewpoint, would be not to elevate this family, says Don Paragoy. We were dirt poor mountaineers. My older sister didn't finish school. Frank, as far as I know, never graduated from high school. They went to a very small school, the ones in the family that did go, called Old Dominion School. With the death of his mother, Frank Paragoy was forced to quit pursuing an education and go to work on the farm full time. The younger kids really needed him. He had learned how to work real hard early in his life, Sister Daisy McReady told the Daily Progress. Those were hard years, but we lived on our garden crops and we raised bees, so we had honey. We'd sell the honey for 15 cents a pint, and berries we'd pick for 10 cents a gallon. Wow. James Paragoy's death in 1935, as mentioned above, caused the further breakup of the family. Daisy, for example, went to live with an older couple near Scottsville. 19-year-old Frank Paragoy moved in with William and Flora Sampson in Charlottesville. Across the street was a lumber yard. Uncle Ed Hildebrand was a foreman at Barnes Lumber Company, remembers Don. And when Frank left Green Mountain in Esmont, he went to work for him. My uncle didn't want to hire him at first because he said Frank was too small. Later, he said Frank was one of the best workers he had. Don Peregoy is quick to emphasize that growing up, he didn't get to see his big brother Frank a great deal, but what he did see impressed him. He stacked up then with the other guys working at Barnes Lumber, maybe just a shade shorter, you know, but physically he was quite sure of himself. Some mention was made then of what big hands he had, big fists. An uncle of mine used to say he wanted to get Frank into boxing, saying he would promote him. I heard people in the family talking one time that Frank had been in jail for being in a fight. Whether the story about being in trouble is true or not, Frank Peregoy was a popular young man. He was quiet and unassuming. He was my brother, and I could stand by his side, see, and listen to him talk to somebody else, remembers Don. I liked him because he was my brother, but everybody seemed to like him. Roy Sampson, William and Florence's son, told the Daily Progress what it was like living with Frank Peregoy during approximately the same period. I was just a kid when he first came to live with us. He would take us kids and give us wooden sticks for rifles and tell us we were fighting a war. He'd tease you all day if you let him. Yes, sir, Frank was a good old boy. It should perhaps come to no surprise that the strapping youngster was interested in playing war, for by 1935, Frank Peregoy had been a member of the National Guard for 4 years. According to military records, wrote Periello, Frank enlisted in the Monticello Guard on July 5th, 1931. He would have been 15 years old. Military records, however, indicate he was 16 years old and show his birth date as April 10th, 1915. Either the military made an error or Peregoy had lied about his age. Little brother Don smiles when he hears of this confusion. You have to understand, he explains, that during the Depression, a lot of fibbing was going on about people's ages. Young boys needed jobs to help support their families. Frank had simply told a white lie to get in. And then there's the matter of the correct spelling of the family name. Military records show it's spelled Peregory, P-E-R-E-G-O-R-Y, adding that extra R. The historical marker on Emmett Street and University Avenue also spells it that way. Both, unfortunately, are wrong. All the family spells it Peregoy, says Don, brother Don, his younger brother. Frank spelled it that way too. Now, I will assume this, that some official or clerk wrote down Peregory, and Frank, he didn't give a damn. I don't think it mattered to him. I have been told it's French, and I have been told that great-great-great-grandpa came here to work in the orchards. Frank Peregoy was officially inducted into federal service for a year's training on February 3, 1941. He had already grown accustomed to hard work and hard living, so military life suited him. Peregoy thrived on the regular exercise and food and the hearty Army camaraderie. John Taylor of Albemarle County recalled for the Daily Progress how during bayonet practice against targets and dummies, Peregoy went through the course and just tore it all to pieces. I mean, he was sticking and smashing the stuffing out of those dummies like you would not believe. When the Monticello Guard returned to Charlottesville 5 months later to take part in the 4th of July festivities, Frank stayed around for the weekend. On Saturday, July 5th, he married Bessie Geneva Kirby, one of the waitresses at Kirby's Beer Joint on Monticello Road just south of Charlottesville. He would later joke with his Army pals that, unhappily, he had spent more nights with his rifle than he had with his bride. In active service, Charlottesville's Monticello Guard became Company K of the 3rd Battalion, 116th Infantry Regiment, one of three regiments along with artillery and support companies in the Army's and the U.S. Army's 29th Division. This particular National Guard force was known as the Blue and Gray Division because it incorporated units from Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia, Northerners and Southerners. The 29th's well-trained guardsmen wore the distinctive yin-yang symboled patch in blue and gray. And I'm sure you all have seen that patch, the 29th Division patch. I think it's nice looking. Like the division's other units, the 116th Infantry bore a proud lineage. It was descended from the 2nd Virginia Regiment, a militia unit first formed in 1760 and had been led by Colonel George Washington in the French and Indian War and Patrick Henry in the early days of the American Revolution. At First Manassas in the Civil War, the men of the 2nd Virginia had stood like a stone wall with General Thomas Jonathan Jackson. There they had defended Henry Hill against numerous federal attacks. In the world-shattering struggle that was fast approaching, the brave soldiers of the 116th Infantry in the 29th Division would be called upon to stand up against a more numerous and more hideous foe. On Sunday, January 11th, 1942, 35 days after Pearl Harbor, Frank Peregoy became the 29th Division first wartime hero. Early that frostbitten morning, the elements of the 116th Infantry were patrolling the North Carolina coast, close to New Bern, when a Company K weapons carrier slid on an icy road and nosedived into the deep waters of an adjacent canal. Most of the men swam out, but a quick roll call revealed that Private Stanley P. Major was missing. Evidently, a strap from his backpack was still caught on the truck. Without a thought, Peregoy dove back into the frigid water, an army knife clenched between his teeth, Tarzan style. Slicing his way through the vehicle's tarpaulin cover, Frank swam down into the back of the truck and cut the unfortunate private loose. When he pushed the lifeless body back up through the hole, other men from Company K grabbed it and pulled it ashore. Thankfully, although Major had lost consciousness, he was revived several hours later back in camp. For his unselfish act of bravery, Corporal Frank Peregoy was decorated with the Soldier's Medal, America's highest non-combat award. In the special ceremony held at Fort A.P. Hill near Fredericksburg, Virginia on June 17, 1942, Peregoy stood on the podium alongside Major General Leonard T. Giroux, the division commander. When members of the 116th Regiment, Regimental Combat Team formally marched past in review, eyes right, Peregoy shyly returned their salute. As soon as he had pinned on the red, white, and blue ribbon, the modest hero, embarrassed by all the hoopla, quietly returned to his daily army routine. The 116th Infantry was shipped off to England aboard the Queen Mary in September of 1942. Assigned to Tidworth Barracks near Andover, much of the next 20 months was spent in intensive training. The guardsmen were marched all over the beautiful English countryside under the dead weight of their backpacks, marched until a 25-mile day became routine. They also practiced amphibious landings, a hint of what was to come. Peregoy, in the process, learned everything about his rifle, inside and out. After the war, a 3rd Battalion officer commented to Charlottesville native Frank Hartman, himself a World War II veteran, that Peregoy, when it came to taking apart and reassembling his weapon, was gifted. He could do it blindfolded. In England, Frank Peregoy also became a deadly accurate marksman. On the morning of June 6th, 1944, here we go. Technical Sergeant Frank Peregoy was riding the choppy waters of the English Channel just offshore of the Normandy beach, codenamed Omaha. The 29th Division had been assigned this sector for the massive Allied D-Day invasion. The 116th Infantry was to lead the division ashore. The division's first wave landed at approximately 6:30 a.m. The second wave, which included the 3rd Battalion, started hitting the beach about an hour later. As the landing craft's doors splashed open, the Virginians vividly remembered their chaplain's quote from Isaiah 43. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. Luckily, our boat team section didn't take any casualties coming in, recalls Chubby Prophet of Company K. But our regiment lost over 800. Through a veritable storm of German gunfire, the 1st and 3rd Battalions of the 116th, along with the attached 5th Ranger Battalion, fought their way to the crest of the bluff overlooking the beach. They became the first elements of the 29th Division to pierce the first line, the enemy's first line of defense. From the top of the rise, the men of Company K, 3rd Battalion, could gaze back down into a hell hole. It looked like a great junkyard, wrote Charlottesville-born Charles Furtenbaker, including landing craft impaled on obstacles, blown by mines and shattered by shell fire. There was a bulldozer with its guts splattered over the sand and another with its occupants so spattered. an arm here, a leg there, a piece of pulp over yonder. There were discarded things all over the beach, life belts, cartridge clips, canteens, pistol belts, bayonets, and K-rations. Among those inanimate objects were the human remains of the 116th Infantry, hundreds of their dead and dying. 2 days later, on the afternoon of June 8th, the Virginians of Company K, 3rd Battalion, found themselves facing a very obstinate German force dug in at Grand Camp Les Bains. After the Monticello Guard had been under fire for 2 hours, Frank Peregoy made his move. Half running, half crouching, the plucky technical sergeant quickly advanced on the first German trench line. From close range, he opened up with unerring fire. Pow, 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 rang the shots from Peregoy's M1. When his clip would fly out, he'd stick another in, Company K veteran John Taylor told the Daily Progress. After he had gone quite a ways, he starts pulling out hand grenades and throwing them all around. I don't know where he got all those hand grenades. At the military crest, at the foe's first line, Frank Peregoy attached his bayonet and gamely jumped in. Obviously, he wasn't concerned with the odds. In the ditch, Peregoy found himself among a squad of enemy riflemen and immediately engaged them, wrote an officer who witnessed the struggle. Faster than they were able to react to his sudden appearance, Peregoy shot and killed 8 German soldiers. 3 more surrendered. Then, with his prisoners in tow, the one-man platoon advanced on the enemy's main position using that same trench for cover. This next objective was a deeply dug-in machine gun nest. As Peregoy approached, the weapon's staccato fire, a regular rat-tat-tat-tat-tat, was still pinning down his company mates. Frank took it on with hand grenades. With a few ground-shaking explosions, grenades well tossed by the Virginian, Peregoy destroyed the position, wrote the battalion officer, and forced the surrender of 32 other German riflemen. In all these heroics, Frank hadn't received so much as a scratch. Peregoy's amazing feat had an immediate effect on the battlefield, as you can imagine. The fact is, the men who were watching all this were so inspired, recalled C.B. Smith, that they charged towards the Germans. At this, the enemy troops that still remained in the pillboxes routed to the rear. Grand Camp fell. Told a few weeks later of his brother's astounding accomplishment, Don Peregoy was not surprised. He was my big brother, see? And even though I didn't see him very often, he still maintained that big brother persona in my imagination. And he could do anything that he wanted to do, anything. So if it came to fighting the enemy, he was the best damn enemy fighter in the world. Unfortunately, a boy's imagination and cold reality are often at odds. Best enemy fighter Frank Dabney Peregoy was killed in action on June 14th, 1944, only 6 days after the combat at Grand Camp. I was within 30 feet of him when it happened, recalled Company K's Chubby Prophet, just across the hedgerow. He was leading men through a gap, attacking across a field. The Germans waited until he got into the opening, then they let him have it. I crawled to where he was, and he was already dead. Peregoy was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor in a ceremony at the Charlottesville City Armory on June 4th, 1945. In attendance were close friends, relatives, units of the Virginia State Guard, and returned members of the Monticello Guard, Company K, 116th Infantry. Brigadier General E.R. Warner McCabe presented the nation's highest award to Bessie Kirby Peregoy, Frank's widow. "You will have the comfort and consolation and satisfaction of knowing," he told her, "that your heroic husband's memory will live forever in the hearts of his country, and his valiant deeds will live in the hearts of his fellow citizens." Today, Frank Dabney Peregoy rests near the beaches of Normandy beneath a white stone marker in the U.S. cemetery at Saint-Laurent-sur-Mer. Thousands of other American headstones surround him. Thanks.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.